Accession number 4384, Reel 8, Mr. J. E. Sutton. This is September 1917 to October 1918.
The enemy guns shelled for shells while some of his infantry was holding out. I took a pot shot at a German pine from behind a tombstone in the cemetery. It was a long shot for a revolver, and the only time I pulled a trigger against the enemy during the war. Did not receive the results, as I was knocked down by a large piece of earth from a nearby shell burst, but was not hurt. Sent back a runner to report of our satisfactory progress. Protective barrage was fired for about 100 minutes while the 1st Wave Infantry were being relieved. Then about 10 a.m. the advance was resumed to the second objective about 2 miles of a fairly open country against scattered resistance. Sent back a report on this progress. Then allowed the Canadian Cavalry Brigade for the Royal Canadian Horse Artillery Batteries. Cavalry did not get far. Horsemen with swords were no match for machine guns and rifles fired from woods and other cover. They penetrated about a mile and then came back. I helped a wounded corporal from his horse and to the dressing station. His description of the action was brief and very descriptive. Just bloody awful. His horse was unharmed, so I used it to ride back to our guns. Our infantry advance was to a line about 1.5 miles beyond the town of Courcelles, a total of about 5 miles. That evening, we moved into a position to our right and a short distance beyond the former German front line. We opened fire at daybreak in support of our infantry attack in conjunction with the French on our left south flank. Our shells were just clearing the rise ahead. When some surrendering Germans started to struggle back, I sent my man O'Leary to pass them behind our guns. Noticed that they came down in groups. When we stopped firing, I asked O'Leary the reason for this. Apparently the word souvenirs has a wide usage, and O'Leary had collected an assortment. Belt buckles, two iron crosses, some watches, pipes, and one loaded Luger automatic. He offered me the pistol, but I told him to unload it and keep the weapon only. Afternoon, we moved ahead to the right of the town of Dendern. That evening at dusk, German planes started to drop bombs. This became a nightly occurrence, disturbing but not too effective. Next day, after an advance by our infantry, I went ahead on foot to locate our next position. Passed through some German wounded who were being tended by their first aid men. We kept on the move for several days. On one occasion, we were beside the Amiens-Cambrai Road, which was our right flank. The French were about 1,000 yards behind our advance. We could see the German field guns firing at the French infantry line. That night, the enemy withdrew to a prepared position about 4 miles back. This a part of the Hindenburg Line. Our guns were out of range, so next day rode with Major Savage to locate a new position. He finally selected a section of the old Somme battlefield trenches. To reach this, we passed a road junction where we saw the results of some of our heavy artillery fire. Wrecked trucks, wagons, and dead horses. Speaking of dead horses, we saw many of our dead cavalry mounts scattered around and beyond Courcelles. These were starting to decay and giving off a terrible smell. Further on the horse subject, we had received a general order late in June 1918 stating that horse meat would be issued 2 days per week in place of beef. were to take effect January 1st, 1918. Late the next day, I load the guns and ammunition wagons to the fields just short of the crossroads, where the section commanders who have gone ahead with the major were to take over. They were not there, so I rode on to the gun position, expecting to meet them, but no sign of them. Major Savage told me to bring on the whole battery. While waiting, some shells fell close so that the vehicles had scattered but were reassembled by Sergeant Southcott. Cut the guns and ammunition in place and led the wagons and gun members back to the horse lines on the outskirts of the Corsairs. We settled down to trench warfare using dugouts which had been repaired and maintained by the enemy. It was a quiet position with very little enemy artillery fire. No casualties of the guns, but three men were killed and four wounded by shell fire at the horse lines. Sergeant Christian, one of those killed, had been wounded at Passchendaele. He had earlier served with Major Savage in the 2nd Division. The evening of August the 28th, we moved back to the area near our starting point of the 8th. It was a long and unpleasant 12 to 14 mile ride along the straight cobblestone poplar lined Amiens to Cambrai Road in bright moonlight with German planes dropping bombs. French infantry were moving up and we were moving out, and there were numerous stops to clear the road. Our gunners could walk, but drivers had to remain mounted, and so did the officers. On top of the horse, you thought about the size of a church. We got through without casualties after about 6 hours. Next morning, Major Savage was missing. He had ridden back to the cemetery where casualties were buried. He had felt the loss of Sergeant Christian very deeply. I started out to locate him. After several hours and many inquiries, I located him in a hospital behind our horse lines. He and his groom were both wounded in one leg by bomb splinters, and both horses were destroyed. When I reported to Colonel Stewart, he asked how much bone damage occurred. I said there was none. Then he said it was hardly possible, as the major's legs were so skinny. We remained in this snowy location for 2 days. Prior to our attack, the German field artillery were located in two valleys. Apparently, they had tried to get their guns away, but our barrage killed horses and men. Nurses in the nearby field hospital said that the smell was almost unbearable for the first 2 weeks when the wind blew from the west. It was still pretty strong at times. After a two-day march, we went into action south of Arras. The Canadian Corps had captured a section of the Hindenburg front and support lines, advancing almost to the Canal du Nord. A section of this canal, which had been under construction before the war, was practically a large dry ditch. We went into action near the South Corps boundary. Captain O'Halloran was in command for a few days until replaced by Staff Captain Gordon from Corps headquarters. He had earlier served with a battery in action, but was not up to date on his gunnery. At a meeting, Colonel Stewart told me to act as Acting Major Gordon's assistant. About mid-September, we went out for a week's rest and to recalibrate our guns. We moved back into our old location on September the 24th. On the 26th, I received a piece of paper from headquarters, 4th Canadian Division Artillery, which reads, "Pass Lieutenant Sutton, 8th Army Brigade, to command post 4th Canadian Division Artillery." This was instructions after the rope to be taken and a warning, "D do not expose yourself. Quite a good view of the area in front of our lines, and for some distance behind, the enemy trenches on each side of the Guelph section of the canal. Splinter from an enemy shell damaged the recoil system of our number 6 gun, putting it out of action. At 11 p.m., we received a barrage map for an attack at 5 a.m., September the 26th. The 4th Canadian Division on the right and the 1st Canadian Division on the left were attacking in the 2-mile uncompleted section of the Canal du Nord. The advance fanned out to about 4 miles wide and 3 miles deep at the end of the first phase after about 2 hours. The 8th Brigade batteries were superimposed on the 4th Canadian Division front with the 24th battery on the right boundary. We fired the first phase only, then moved up to a position about a mile beyond the Canal du Nord. After a protective barrage of about 1 hour, the creeping barrage resumed and the infantry advanced about a mile to the second objective, also extending the line to the left. For this phase, the 24th battery fired smoke shells at almost extreme range to blot out the view from the high ground to the right, surrounding Bourlon Woods. After another pause, the advance was resumed and reached the third objective about a mile ahead and beyond the last of the German trench system. At night, the 3rd Canadian Division moved in on the right of the 4th Division and the 11th British Division on the left of the 1st Canadian Division. We moved ahead about a mile and a half and opened fire on 2 suspected strong points and on a sunken road. The enemy withdrew to partially constructed defenses in a mouthfulling line. Holding north for 2 days, he withdrew across the canal to St. Quentin into the city of Cambrai. Our infantry advanced to the west bank of the canal. The canal de l'Escorte swung around the north side of the city. On September the 30th, we received the following, quote, "Very secret, 3rd Canadian Division of Tilley, 2158, September 30th, 1918. Reference attached tracing for the barrage on October the 1st. 3rd Canadian Division is attacking with the 4th Canadian Division on its left and the 1st Canadian Division on the left of the 4th. This is the end of the quote. The tracing shows the jumping off line, first and second objective. Final details issued later gave 0 hour at 5 a.m. October the 1st. Rates of fire and types of ammunition to be used, also special targets for 4.5 inch howitzers. The attack was successful and established our line along the canal bank on 2 sides of the city. All bridges across the canals were destroyed by the enemy. We moved to the right and a short distance ahead into a field of wheat which had not been harvested and was infested with long-eared field mice. Because of enemy night bombings, the men slept 2 in a hole, a foot or so deep. Battery headquarters was in a shell hole squared off and covered with a tarpaulin. We were firing after dark when an enemy plane dropped several bombs close ahead of our guns. No damage, just a shell of dirt. We tried to battery headquarters where Captain Gordon was asleep on one of the battery stretchers. We moved belts, tunic, boots, and spurs, and occupied the other stretcher. While something jumped on my head, battered the mouth out. Immediately heard an outbreak of cussing from the next stretcher. I kept quiet. Next morning, Snuffy Gordon said, "Cutting last night, runaway brown mouse jumped right in my mouth." Some days later, I told him what had happened. He got the nickname of Snappy because of the speech defect. And shared an observing station with the 9th and 10th artillery brigades. Nearby was a former German depot, still heavily stocked with artillery ammunition. On my turn for this duty, I visited the infantry battalion headquarters to get a line on enemy weapons which were bothering them. We got chased out of a house in Tilloy by artillery fire. That night, after taking the 8 p.m. to midnight shift, I retired with two signalers to a dugout in a railway cutting. I was awakened by a signaler with the news that enemy shell fire had ignited a large pile of tear gas shells close to our location. We gathered up our belongings and got out in a hurry, went back along our line about a half a mile, and got in touch with brigade headquarters, reporting our change in location and the reason. The fire continued to spread, and enemy guns did their best to keep it going. Finally, the whole dump blew up. We got some fragments in our location. We surmised that the place had been mined, and the heat from the fire caused the detonation. Smoke was continually rising from the city of Cambrai, doubtless due to German action, as our guns had not shelled the city at any time during the attack. Most of the frontage beyond the canal was high stone walls of barracks and warehouses. To the north, the canal banks were more accessible from both sides. I was informed on October the 7th that I would be in command of two 18-pounder guns attached to the 4th Canadian Mounted Rifle Infantry Battalion for an attack at 5 a.m. October the 9th to capture the city. I reported to the infantry commanding officer and asked for instructions. He said he was an infantry commander and the handling of the guns was up to me. I did get the location of their objective and told him that I had learned the proposed site of a pontoon bridge and that it would not be completed until 11 a.m. In a talk with infantry company commanders, I learned that they were concerned about some enemy machine guns sighted in some houses about 300 yards back from the canal. I promised to give these some attention and to cease fire before the barrage reached this point. Picked out a gun location and returned to the battery. Was given my choice and selected the left section with Sergeants Breckenridge and Southcott as gun commanders. Talked with them and made arrangements for rations for men and horses for 24 hours. Could not move my guns until 4 a.m. October the 9th. Arrived at chosen site to find it occupied by some British guns. This upset my calculations. So we went into action on the forward slope of a rise about 1,600 yards from my target and in full view. Fired 20 rounds per gun, but did not see any machine gun or hear any rifle or bomb sounds as our infantry advanced against no opposition. The Germans had withdrawn. Moved guns and teams to a less exposed spot close to the canal and gave orders to water and feed horses and the cooks to prepare and serve the men's breakfast. Mounted and set out with my groom to what had been the main entrance to the city. Left horses with groom and climbed across a partially wrecked bridge into the city. Beyond the main square, I caught up with the infantry. They said they had not seen any Germans nor fired a shot. The inhabitants had been evacuated by the Germans, and that had been large stores and homes for empty shells. No doors, no windows, and no trace of any metals. Some of the buildings were still smoldering. returned and rode back to the main battery position while I reported verbally to Major Gordon and by phone to Colonel Stewart. It was in time for breakfast, after which I rode back to my guns. Visited the big site and was told I could get across the canal about 10:30 a.m. The engineer colonel reprimanded me for keeping my drivers mounted while crossing the bridge. Told him that this would be contrary to the orders given me. Riding through the city, I saw one German. He had been dead for several days, and one horse, but not for long dead. Went into action beside a farmhouse a short distance northeast of Cambly Citadel, a very impressive fortress-like building. Found my way to battalion headquarters in a house behind the railway tracks which ran around the city and which were their objective. They had seen no sign of the enemy, and patrols which had been almost a mile beyond had not met any resistance. Looked over the farmhouse beside my guns as a possible place to spend the night. Was surprised to see it was complete with windows and doors and that the grounds were well kept. Went inside and noticed a very unpleasant smell in a fully furnished house. In a room off the hall, I found the reason for these conditions. Laid out on a table was a high-ranking German officer, fully clothed and complete with decorations, and with no sign of any injury. He had been dead for several days. I closed the door and left him to rest in peace. Picked out a house without windows and doors in a row a short distance behind the guns. Sent two ammunition wagons back to the main battery and the gun and other wagon teams to the location beside Cambly Citadel. About 5:30 p.m., German 5.9-inch howitzers started to shell the area using some airbursts, which are especially bad against men and horses in the open. Went back and got them away by some side streets that ordered us to go back to the main battery. Next morning, Lieutenant Jenks brought up gun and wagon teams and we rejoined the battery. Major Savage was back in command, fully recovered from his wounds. Colonel Stewart had left to England to take a course, and Major Craig of the 30th Battery was in command of the brigade. Next AM we moved out, and that evening went into action about 10 miles northwest, placed in the canal de la Sense. On October the 12th, I was called to brigade headquarters and told by Major Craig that my leave warrant had come through to start October the 17th through November the 1st. An attack was scheduled for Friday, October the 13th, to effect a crossing of the canal. He advised that I get away early on the morning of October the 13th. The nearest railhead was at Arras, about 30 miles away. He told me not to get on the lead boat until October the 17th. About 9 a.m., October the 13th, I was standing at a temporary bridge across the canal looking for a ride, when a general's car with four flags, driven by a sergeant with a captain as passenger, stopped to let a truck get clear of the bridge. I asked the captain where he was going. He said as far as Arras, but that I had better ask the sergeant about a ride, as he had done. The sergeant told me to sign in and ask where I was going. I told him I was going to Belon. That was also his destination to pick up the general the next day. Dropped the captain to the officer's club at Arras about 10 a.m. So now I had a Vauxhall limousine with a chauffeur to drive me across France. Stockfish and Pearl were our both drinks and lunch. Arrived in Boulogne about 4:30 p.m. for a party with a sergeant, giving him 50 francs for his dinner, which he said was too much. Had dinner and stayed at the officer's club. Next day, I rode out to the base hospital just north of Boulogne on a very sad mission. My sister Abby had written that her husband had died of wounds late in September and was buried in the cemetery near the hospital. She had asked me to get a picture of his grave. I knew that this would not be allowed, but did have a talk with a foreign nurse. She told me that his wounds had been such that there was no hope for his recovery. An orderly took me to this cemetery where I saw rows of wooden crosses, each with an aluminum plate giving the name, unit, regimental number, and date of death. These were replaced after the war with more permanent markers and graves rearranged in the permanent cemetery. Stayed overnight at the officers' club where I met some officers who were leaving for England the next morning. Company down to the lead boat. When it had sailed, the military landing officer, a major, asked why I had not gone on the boat. Told him that my leave did not start until the 17th. He then told me that he needed an officer on a duty boat which left about 3 p.m. The duty boat crossed each day taking reinforcements to France and returning with some few men going to England on duty. An officer was required to see that men wore life belts while aboard. So that now I arrived in London the evening of October the 15th, almost 2 days before my leave started. Stayed overnight at the Piccadilly Hotel. Got money from the bank the next morning. Phoned my sister Abby at the butler's home and joined her there. Told her of my visit to the hospital outside Boulogne and gave her a description of her husband's grave. Shortly after the end of the war, she saw the original burial place and later visited the new cemetery, then completed, close to the old site. Stayed in London 2 days, then visited Turnberry, Canterbury, and Faversham. Returned to London and revisited the butlers one night. Then to Guildford and Whitley Camp for 2 days. Back to London for the final 3 days. There was a false rumor of an armistice. Among the crowd along the Strand, I ran into my sister Grace and her intended husband, Al Sullivan. Sunday evening, the last of my leave, I stopped at the hotel desk for my key. Saw Colonel Stewart, our brigade commanding officer, and a British colonel enter the lobby. After they left the desk, I overheard them complaining that they could not get a room or a drink. I told them that I could not help them with a room, but I did have a pot bottle of whiskey in my room. They accepted the invitation and emptied the bottle. Next morning, after eating breakfast at Victoria Station with the captain of the Oxfordshire Light Infantry, we were stopped by the railway transportation officer and told not to take the lead train, but wait for the duty train, which left 2 hours later. Another delay occurred at Folkestone due to high seas in the English Channel. We landed at Boulogne about 5 p.m., stayed overnight at the officers' club, and left the next morning by train for Arras. Was fortunate to get a ride in a civilian YMCA car as far as Valenciennes, about 50 miles. At a canteen, I learned the Canadian artillery had been in action just west of the city on November the 3rd. Finally caught up with the 24th Battery in action outside Crum the morning of November the 4th. San Miguel had left the evening before for two retrieves, so they were short of officers, and I took command of the center section. The towns beyond Valenciennes were joined with civilians evacuated by the Germans from territory as far back as Cambrai. The enemy were putting up only light resistance, chiefly machine gun fire and shell fire from long-range heavy guns, practically no field artillery. His losses in artillery had been serious since the 8th of August. The Canadian Corps alone had captured over 2,000 guns, about 80% being field guns. The morning of November the 5th, we moved into Quen. A heavy shell killed three horses and wounded two men. In less than an hour, every scrap of meat was removed from the dead horses by the civilians. I took the center section forward under command of Major Savage to silence some German machine guns along a railway embankment. We were firing from a level crossing and doing quite well when some shells fell just in front of our guns, fired from behind by the 4.5-inch Forrester battery of our brigade. November the 8th, we occupied a position beyond Quen that devoid of the firing as we were practically in Mons. Our infantry pushed the enemy back into the city. This was the area where the original British Expeditionary Force made their first contact with the Germans in August 1914. At dusk, November the 10th, I took two guns forward. It was planned to cross the dry moat surrounding Bump Mons at 5 a.m. November the 11th. But the 2nd Canadian Division on our right occupied the city ahead of us. The 42nd Battalion, with which I was operating, moved ahead at dawn. I walked a short distance into the city. A staff officer told me there was to be an armistice at 11 a.m. Returning to the guns, I met three men in civilian clothes. One saluted me and said he was a sergeant, and another man, a private of the Sherwood Foresters,